Good afternoon and welcome to the concluding session of today's WISCATES Forum on Funding and Accountability in Public Higher Education. I'm Noel Still. And to conclude today, we will welcome back yet another UW-Madison graduate and WISCATE affiliate, President King Alexander. For those of you who don't know King or President Alexander, King Alexander was named the 6th president of California State University Long Beach in November of 2005 after serving as the president of Murray State University in the great state of Kentucky from 2001 through 2005. Dr. Alexander is a well-respected national expert in domestic and international higher education finance and public policy. His research on university revenue and expenditure patterns has been featured in The Economist, The New York Times, The Chronicle of Higher Education, The Boston Globe, The Australian, and not at least and not less important, the Christian Science Monitor. Dr. Alexander's efforts to improve federal higher education policy has contributed to the development of congressional legislation, advancing the net tuition concept in order to enhance public accountability and future funding of higher education institutions. Prior to serving as president of two public universities, Dr. Alexander was a faculty member and director of the higher education program at the University of Illinois from 1997 to 2001. In addition to being president of CSU Long Beach, he also serves as a faculty affiliate at Cornell University's Higher Education Research Institute, CHERI. Dr. Alexander received his PhD from UW-Madison in Higher Education Finance and Public Policy, and also received a Master's of Science degree from Oxford University, that English institution, in Comparative Educational Policy, and also a bachelor's degree from the hockey powerhouse of St. Lawrence University in political science. One other thing that I do want to mention, King, obviously, he also served as chair of the technical working group of the Volunteer System of Accountability, the initiative involving, obviously, Nostalgic Askew and others. So today, King's presentation is titled Accountability and the Public Good, Measuring and Financing True Institutional Commitment to Public Needs. I'm very proud and honored to have Dr. Alexander return to his home campus.
Thank you, Noel.
Welcome, King Alexander.
Thank you, Noel. Thank you. I'll stand and thank you, Noel, for that very cordial and nice introduction. It's always a pleasure for me to come back here for many reasons. One is that whatever I say, whether you like it or not, and particularly if you don't like it, you can always blame it on my advisor because he's sitting right here. And many of the faculty that were a part of my doctoral program, Joe Corey is here. Joe's commitment to students, commitment to the public good. I don't think there's a university in the United States that has been more true to that commitment in its research and its efforts to do what's right in public higher education for those who need it the worst. And for all you students that are out there, how many are current students in the higher ed program and other programs? You've got a wonderful incubator right here, and I encourage you to take full advantage of the fact that you've got a very powerful university system, of which there are only 25 other systems in the United States, and it sits right here. You've got the top research university, public research university. Second, I think those numbers will be out, but it'll be the top research university in federal funding this year, just behind Johns Hopkins. I think Wisconsin will hit $800 million this year. The third best, according to the Shanghai ranking, in public university in the United States, but 16th best in the world. You've got state capital right down the street. You have all the policy and all the finance, all the law. You've got it all right here. And it's a tremendous incubator. And I encourage you to take full advantage of this place. Take full advantage of the expertise and the knowledge that's here. And build the type of friendships that still exist. And I know a number of you were in the program with me. And thank you for coming today. I started to do a PowerPoint on this issue of accountability, but quickly moved away from it. Because what I wanted to share with you is really the last 2.5 years of dealing with the Spellings Commission, working with Charles Miller, being chair of the VSA, which you'll hear more about next month when Nostalgic releases. So their press release will be at their national meeting in New York on November 13th on the Volunteer System of Accountability. ASCU will do a release. The ASCU institutions, the comprehensive publics, will do their release on the VSA a week later. What you have in your hands is a handout, and Cal State Long Beach is one of the templates, one of the six universities that will be used as a template for other universities to follow. I want to share a lot of how this evolved, the pros and cons of it, what we're doing to strengthen it, what we're doing to bring attention to it. But first, let me share with you just a little, I'd say, experience that I was president of a university in a very rural setting, Kentucky, Western Kentucky, for 4.5 years. Kentucky, as David mentioned, tax effort. Kentucky is a poor state that tries real hard to fund higher education, and generally is a top 10 state in its effort. By that means its ability to support higher education is always generally pretty good. Its ability to support K-12 is always pretty good. Mississippi does the same thing. West Virginia does the same thing. Arkansas, New Mexico, many poor states that actually try real hard, they just don't have the tax or fiscal capacity to support what you hope they would support down the road. Now, the flip side of that is we have many wealthy states that, quite frankly, don't do much for higher education at all. And perhaps the worst state in the United States, I'd say, if you happen to be born there, is the state of Colorado. State of Colorado does nothing for anybody. They're a rich state with very, very limited support of higher education, and quite frankly, has done nothing but live off out-of-state revenues from out-of-state students that have poured into the state of Colorado because they want to come to the mountains and they want to ski in the winter and they have access to ski slopes. So there's very big differences, drastic differences between states, and we have 50 systems of higher education within our states. California is a state that generally ranks about 10th to 13th. It's tried real hard. We're a lot like North Carolina. California still believes that you can be a publicly funded system without privatizing everything you do. Now, North Carolina fits in there. A number of other states are still fighting what I call the public fight. Hawaii, other states that are trying hard to finance our university, Cal State Long Beach, has 37,000 students. We're expected to grow by 2.5% each year, and we have a statewide campus compact with the state legislature and the governor that guarantees us about a 6-7% increase in funding if we reach that 2.5% increase. Now, that 2.5% may not sound like a lot to you, but 2.5% was 30,000 new students to the CSU. The CSU is 23 universities, 450,000 strong today, the largest system in the United States. And our institution grew, quite frankly, by 2,000 students since last year, and scrambling to get classrooms. And 1,000 of those students actually grew because increased enrollment, but another 1,000 of those students grew because of increased retention and success in keeping many of our students that we might have lost. California is a bit of an anomaly on most of the trends going on around the United States also, because demographics, and I think you could look to Florida and Texas and a few other states, when you take a look at demographics, what you'll find in California is that we're one of the few states that as we actually have the demand for higher education has increased, the selectivity of our institutions has indeed increased, so too has our low-income access to our institutions. And for our institution, for example, has grown by 20 percentage points just since 1992 in access of Pell Grant students to our campus. The UC institutions, the 10 UC institutions, have also grown. That is not consistent with the national trend. As tuitions go up around the country, as institutions work to privatize what they can because of state cutbacks, institutions all over the United States have turned their backs on low-income students. Madison has gone from 16% down to about 12%, and the numbers are declining annually. Madison is much more representative of the national trend. Virginia is down to 6%. University of Vermont, I heard you're from the University of Vermont. I think you're at 9% now. That is actually rivals many wealthy private institutions. I'm really not here to talk about Madison. I'm not here to talk about research institutions. I'm here to talk about where the bulk of our students reside. And of the four-year institutions and the community colleges that are battling to keep costs low, the four-year institutions and community colleges who are battling to keep their expenditures low, and the four-year institutions and community colleges out there who also understand that being public means making sure that low-income access and diverse populations have access and success on your own campus. The CSU with 450,000 students, we also have, we're 54% students of color. With regard to diversity in the United States, we're headed that way. We're all moving, it's coming It's coming to Wisconsin, and it's coming up through Florida, it's coming up through New Mexico, it's coming up through Arizona, Texas, and many other institutions. This raises a whole different series of questions and issues. Now, before I get to the volunteer system of accountability, I just want to share with you probably four driving forces that led to this outcome. And it's a partial outcome on many of the things that we need to talk about. Many people criticize the Spellings Commission for coming after higher education. Well, anytime the federal government comes after higher education, there's criticism. If you remember the early 90s when the Sprees started, how many remember the Spree debate? Actually, this was Clinton's push to put the lid on some of the for-profit institutions from milking the public sector through direct student aid. Didn't come out that way. Higher education unified. They were unified in a front, and they killed the Spree project about 3 years later. But what is different about today in accountability? You know, accountability, normally, most states and most public universities say, oh gosh, accountability. Well, normally we're used to states coming at us with accountability. And for this purpose, states are generally trying to cut your budget or put in performance-based systems. Today, accountability is very different. And I'll ask you these questions because I think that the federal government indeed has a right and an obligation to pay attention to what's been going on for the last 40 years. I think Professor St. John pointed out that we haven't had a good debate in higher education in the United States in 40 years, and we haven't. We're still doing the same things incrementally over the last 40 years, while other countries have had major debates and have advanced way beyond us in lots of areas. And I'll just give you an example. In the 70s, we had the highest level of educational attainment in the world. Today, there are only two countries in the OECD world that will have an older generation more educated than its younger generation. That's Germany and the United States. And most of those other countries have jumped substantially in increasing their access to college. In the 70s, we were ranked first in population that obtained a degree. Now we're ninth. Male population has dropped from third to fifth. Female population with tertiary education, higher education, we've gone from second to 10th. Graduation rates, we're now at 14th in the world. And then you got a whole series of engineering, we're 27 of 30. Sciences, we're 25th of 30 OECD countries. The data is pretty compelling that we've been stagnant as a nation. We've been stagnant as a nation. What I am going to try to offer you is some reasons why we've been stagnant and where we perhaps need to go from here. Well, one issue was that you must go back 40 years to decide what the federal government ultimately did in higher education in 1965 to 1975, right around that time. The federal government decided to provide widespread access through direct student aid movement, the direct student aid funding system. Now, it also decided that an important player in all this was to make sure that private institutions and the diversity of American higher education system didn't go under. Because private universities were, it's in the Carnegie reports, they were saying they're all going under if this structure continues. Have a market-based voucher system in higher education. Let the federal government funnel money through the students. Well, it started well, but what ended up happening was that, as mentioned earlier, we shifted to loans in the late 70s. In addition to that, the federal government decided that states, even though most had constitutional restrictions about giving public funds to private places, for-profit and not-for-profit, that they'd create the SSIG fund, which basically gives matching resources to states to adopt direct student aid programs. The problem was the federal government didn't pay attention to how the states implemented those programs. Many of them became tuition equalization programs. And by its very name, a tuition equalization program creates an economic incentive. If I'm a president of a university and the state's going to jump in and equalize what I'm doing if I raise my tuition rates, there's an inherent economic incentive to raise your tuition and fees. Since we moved to this loan-based system now, the federal government in the 70s was supposed to augment what states did for higher education, not become the primary player. Now, this past year, the federal government surpassed all state funding through federal programs. States provide $85 billion in support for higher education. But this year, through loan programs, grant programs, tuition tax credits, and everything, now the federal government provides $90 billion through revenue-based programs to those institutions. Now that has created a series of, I would call institutional behavior issues. It's called a series of behavioral issues at state legislatures. And I remember a quote from the state senate, our speaker, the speaker of the state senate, president of the state senate in the state of Kentucky, in a parking lot outside the University of Louisville, who said, "Why should we give you any more money when you can just raise tuition and get it from the federal government?" Now, that means we can raise tuition and we can increase our grant support, but we also can increase our loan support. Right now, I want to come back to that because currently a big battle in Washington is whether or not to expand the loan cap from $23,000 to $30,000. And I'll tell you where we're what side we're falling on with regard to this side. So the federal government wants greater accountability, and everybody started squirming. Well, right now, there's never been a greater demand for higher education in American history than it is today. Should they be concerned and should they be interested? Yes. Should we expect higher degree of scrutiny? Yes. Society wants not only higher degree of access, but as all the economic indicators point to, they want higher completion and success rates. Now, what even our legislators have figured out is that going to college and dropping out does virtually nothing for your earnings capacity today. The high school graduate today will earn $32,000 average earnings capacity for the rest of their life. A college dropout will only earn $37,000. There's virtually no difference between someone who goes to college today and drops out and someone who didn't pursue college at all after high school. Our legislators are understanding that. It doesn't matter if they're Republican or if they're Democrat. The big difference occurs if they graduate from those institutions. And if they graduate with an Associate of Arts degree, it jumps to $45,000. If they graduate from a baccalaureate degree granting institution, it jumps to $57,000. And those disparities are widening each and every year. So, quite frankly, it makes no difference whatsoever if you start and go to college and stop today for your own economic well-being, and people have figured this out. So it's not just a demand for access, but it's a demand for success and completion and graduation rates. That's why there's a greater scrutiny on accountability at the state legislative level as well as the federal level. Society wants greater efficiency. The proclamation is everybody needs some form of higher education. How are we going to finance greater forms of higher education? Well, you got to pay attention to efficiencies. This morning, the conversation surfaced about expenditures. The battle going on in Washington about exposing your per-student expenditures is intense. And I'll just share with you how these numbers have developed over the last, since 1980. Public master's degree universities, on average, four-year comprehensive institutions have increased their per-student expenditures. This is adjusted for inflation, from $11,000 to about $16,000, an increase of 44%. Sounds like something you can criticize. It's an increase of about $5,000 per student over the last 27 years. Private for-profit institutions, well, we don't have the data because they won't give it to us. Private church-related liberal arts colleges have increased their per-student expenditures from $12,000 to $21,000 a year, an increase of $8,000 per student, nearly 60% increase. Research institutions like Madison have increased their per-student expenditures, E&G expenditures, from $19,000 to $34,000, a 78% increase per student. Roughly about this university spends about $15,000 more per year on a student than they did in 1980. But the institutions who Madison's competing with, the private research institutions, have increased from $32,000 a year to nearly $70,000 a year per student, an increase of nearly $35,000 per student. That's a 110% increase in per student expenditures. Should the federal government pay attention to this? Should they be paying attention to who actually is doing an efficient job to educate students and provide high quality educational experiences for many more students? I say yes, they should. And they should pay attention to expenditures. This means government is going to start helping to determine or trying to determine where their next investment dollar should go. And it should go perhaps to an institution or those institutions who are doing the best job for the resources that they have. The Spellings Commission also said that parents don't know enough about higher education. This is Margaret Spellings. She said, she had her own daughter that went around the country, and they couldn't find information about colleges. All they found were the glossy brochures that we all give to our students that basically go ahead and describe how unique we are as a university, but then we describe our uniqueness in the exact same way as every other institution. So this VSA is the vehicle, is the first initial vehicle to provide more information to tell parents and students. Accreditation, the secret garden of accreditation. Now, when the Spellings Commission went after reforms on accreditation, higher education went nuts. Let me point out, though, that how many in the general public or in any legislature around the United States understands or has any understanding of how accreditation works?
Within a campus.
The multiple accreditation agencies, quite frankly, the accrediting bodies have gotten themselves in this situation because they have accredited so many institutions, the standards vary so considerably, that when asked, can you tell us what types of outcomes and quality has truly been produced by the institution, they can't tell you. We're still focusing on the inputs, not the outputs. Naturally, the next move is on cost and affordability. They're concerned about cost and affordability. What role has the federal government had in encouraging states to remove themselves from their responsibility to fund public higher education? Quite frankly, you've got $90 billion sitting out there, $90 billion, and many state legislators have figured this out, that they don't have to increase their funding for higher education. In fact, if tuition goes up, then they can rely on the federal programs to provide those revenue streams. Who truly is the loser in those programs? Well, the students are the loser, because that has amounted to the type of loan debt that we're seeing. And if loan caps are increased another $7,000 by about 30%, you'll see the same type ramifications and consequences occur in the next 5 to 10 years. Many of the loan programs, as you know, are cost sensitive. Measuring costs, measuring efficiency, controlling for affordability, paying attention to who's doing a good job. These are all important questions that Spellings was attempting to get a hold of and wrestle with. Ultimately, many of these issues led to the Spellings Commission report, which initially was very critical of higher education. Then it backed away from its criticism. And as a response to what Spellings said and did, the public university said, we will provide more information to the public at large about what we do and how well we do it. That is what you have in your hand. This is the template that will be released next month. Now, this is our template from our institution. But even the politics, I must tell you, the politics of getting these variables on the page was truly intense. And in fact, many of the most important variables, if you're committed to public good, public needs, were left off for a variety of reasons. If you turn to the last page, page 4, yesterday this was approved in the Council of Presidents in the state of California, that we're going to have our own VSA. And that's because these issues are left off the table. The federal government wants to tell parents and students what a percentage graduation rate is. Well, quite frankly, that devalues public higher education. Percentage is a proxy of something much larger, which is the number that you're putting into the economy. This university puts about 9,000 graduates into the economy every year. Our university, Cal State Long Beach, 8,200 graduates a year. And our greatest strength for public universities have never been explained or we have never made the case with our state legislature by when we dilute ourselves and diminish ourselves by focusing solely on percentages, we're missing the point on the foundation of our economy. Our university alone graduated 8,100 students, which is more graduates than Princeton has students. Our university alone graduated 8,100 students, which is more than Vanderbilt, Notre Dame, and Dartmouth put together. These are important. These numbers are important to an economy. When we compare ourselves with these OECD figures, it's numbers. It's numbers that are driving whether we're going to succeed or not in this. And percentages are a part of the measurement, but they should never be the entire measurement, especially if you're a large public university that prides itself on serving many students and doing it well. Now, what you'll find on this back page also are high-demand fields. Many of these fields that you mentioned, engineering, school, teaching, public schools, nursing, many of these fields are also the fields that many of the for-profit sector higher education won't touch, but are in the greatest demand when you talk to state legislators and you talk to taxpayers. Teachers in our schools, nurses in our hospitals, engineers in the community, health-related fields. The demographics of America are shifting, and David, you did a great job pointing this out. Now, I think one of the greatest lines I ever heard is the same people who wanted free drugs in the 60s are the same ones who want them today. That's the political reality. Health-related fields are going to be popular, and they're going to continue to be popular, and our students are going to either provide those fields or not as graduates. Now, this other piece, I want to take you to the bottom of this, on economic diversity. We got about 3/4 of the universities out there, four-year institutions, who don't want to talk about economic diversity. Now, there are three categories in economic diversity, which I think are very important. And if you are indeed public, you're paying attention to these things. Pell Grant eligibility. Why aren't we measuring first-generation students? Well, we've never collected the data. We have more data on K through 12 low-income students than we do in higher education, because a lot of schools won't collect the data, and some people don't realize that it's important. But we do have Pell Grant numbers, and as you can see, these are our Pell Grant numbers at Cal State Long Beach. You can't measure the effectiveness of a university without taking into account the economic diversity and socioeconomic status of its students. The second category is degrees awarded to Pell Grant students. Which institutions are doing a good job getting those students through the system? The third area is, the institution actually increasing or decreasing its commitment to lower income students over the period of time? And that's the third category. Now, many nostalgic institutions, and you'll find in the independent sector VSA, which is a two-page document, you won't find any of this on their document. You won't find this in the nostalgic document. You won't find this in the independent university document. Now, the other area is net tuition and fees. Net tuition and fees is in the process of being written into the reauthorization of the Higher Ed Act by George Miller, Representative Miller. Net tuition is simply a concept that says, what does the average full-time student pay to go to your institution? When you take out the grants that are available from the state and from the federal government. And for example, our sticker price, and this is California, this is, goes back to the point that I made about fighting hard to keep costs low and keep the public engaged. Our listed price is $2,864 a year. The National Public University average is $6,100. But the average FTE that goes to our university is only going to pay $1,698. This type of ratio will probably be true for most public universities and will certainly be true for most private universities, but they don't want to make that information available, because they can say that they cost $48,000, then they can work a deal. They don't want to tell the federal government that they actually charge the average student $25,000. So you're going to hear a lot more about net tuition. It's written into the legislation. It's going to be a part of the VSA. There is a net tuition calculation in the other part of the VSA where families and students can put their own family income that will tell them how much they'll qualify for in grants and aid. They need this as well, because there are 20 different student aid programs that are out there. And maneuvering through this system is almost impossible for our faculty to even maneuver through. So are they right to ask for greater transparency, greater accountability? Yeah, they are. Certainly they are. Most of our low-income students don't even know what they actually qualify for in many of the larger institutions. And finally, for public institutions, we're putting our average loan debt and the state average and the national average in loan debt of what our students actually pay, and the percentage of students who are going into debt. Now, a lot of institutions don't want to make this information available either. So what we call this page, and what we hope will happen in Florida and Texas and other states who we know that will probably look very good on these public good contributions, is that this type of information will be made available, not because students and parents want to know it, because students and parents really don't want to know this back page. Taxpayers, legislators, and others want to know this. They want to know how well you're actually doing. That's what this VSA is about. Finally, let me get to the main point that it, and I've left the policy paper up here. Something we also forgot in 1972. One reason why low-income students are not going to, their choices are so limited, and a lot of schools say their choice is limited because there's not enough grant support to allow them to go to those institutions. Well, quite frankly, in most cases, it's not a question of grants and loans that help students make choices to go to higher cost places. The big question around that is the fact that institutions don't necessarily want a lot of low-income students. One fundamental rule in education is, and the K through 12 sector knows this best, it's this fundamental rule of all these court cases, is that it costs you more to educate lower-income students. It costs you more. Now, that doesn't mean you're not going to stay committed to the 9% low-income student population you've always been committed to and dump more resources on them. But what do the institutions who serve 55% Pell Grant eligible students do? What does the community college sector do when they've kept their costs low because they know they would drive these students away, while at the same time they need help for remedial at work, they need help to get them up to college readiness, they need help to at advising help? These students cost money. They cost more money than more affluent students do. Everybody knows that. That's a fundamental concept in education. Now, in 1972, there was a joint program that was supposed to coincide with the Pell Grant, and it was called the Cost of Education Allowances. Cost of Education Allowances were to follow the Pell Grant student to the institution. So if a Pell Grant student got $3,000 for grant support, the institution who chooses to serve that student got $2,500 grant that follows the Pell Grant student to the institution that then helps the university. Not only does it create an additional incentive to serve that student, but it helps the institution fund for the educational needs of that student. Now, that grant got left off. The companion program was left off entirely in 1972. And in many ways, we adopted a similar program in 1965 for the K through 12 schools in the Title I program. And the only difference is we tied it to state fiscal effort. And currently, the federal government has no provision whatsoever to help states maintain their support to higher education. So if this proposal asks that if we revisit the concept of institutional aid at the part of the federal government level, we tie that institutional aid to a federal match, just like we do in the Title I program, and base that federal match on the amount of state support staying and maintenance of effort provision, so states maintain their commitment to higher education. Otherwise, they lose the federal commitment. This sounds familiar? It's what we do in Medicaid. It's what we do in Title I. Title I funds from the federal government are not to be supplanted by state funds. And David pointed out a number of supplanting issues with private gifts. These monies have been supplanted now for 40 years without any provision on the part of the federal government to stop states from removing themselves from their higher education obligation. Naturally, higher education is always going to be the first item cut in every state budget when the budgets turn bad, because there are no federal incentives to maintain those states at certain levels. Now, and I hear this anecdotally, and I see it in work in many state legislatures. That's why Medicaid's protected, because they're not going to lose the federal match. That's why Title I funds are protected, because they'll lose more funding of those poor schools if we don't implement a federal match for the type of per student expenditures that are being given in higher education. Now, the plan is, actually, you can read more about the proposal. Now, the College Board is going to recommend, they're doing an access and affordability, where the College Board will make a recommendation of this kind soon that will come out. Michael McPherson and Sandy Baum are on board with this, and Ron Ehrenberg, they're very much on board with this. We've got a number of presidential candidates who are very interested in this, and quite honestly, for the first time in our history, we've got the type of legislative support in Washington where a provision of maintenance of effort was added into the legislation, into the Reconciliation Act that was signed 2 weeks ago. Now, that provision was dropped out 2 weeks before President Bush signed it because the Council for State Governments didn't want the maintenance of effort provision in there. And what the maintenance of effort provision stated was that in order to receive your LEAP program funds, in order to receive the federal program LEAP funds, a state must maintain a certain degree of current level of support for their students that currently exist in their states right now. If they remove themselves beyond a certain percentage point, 12 percentage point over a two-year period, they reduce themselves, then they lose their LEAP funding. This was a provision that was added by George Miller. It was a provision that was added by Tierney of Massachusetts, and a provision that had a lot of support. We're increasingly seeing that legislators are starting to understand that a federal partnership with states is what's needed. And this partnership can't drive states away from funding higher education, but needs to drive states toward funding and protecting their own state commitments to higher education. Otherwise, these trends will continue, and quite frankly, the only argument that we will have in Washington is how much more we'll increase a loan cap or how much more we're going to increase another grant cap, which will lead to further divestment on the state and further divestment throughout the country in higher education. The federal government is too instrumental a partner in Medicaid, it's too instrumental a partner in Title I for them to avoid their responsibility in being an instrumental partner in higher education as well. This maintenance of effort provision is the type of provision that we need to have. And I think you'll see states starting to feel the pressure to maintain their commitment to higher education. Now, in conclusion, let me point out that people say, well, states will still remove themselves from this because there's only so much money. This is about social choices. This is about social choices. We're spending $530 billion in the Department of Defense every year, which is more, according to The Economist, it's more than the rest of the world combined last year at $490 billion. This is about social choices. This nation has never been wealthier as a nation. And when you, in the Luxembourg Income Study that just came out, based on our tax effort as a nation, we actually rank 27th of 30 countries now in our redistribution, government redistribution of programs and funding for government programs, including education. This country has never actually been wealthier in terms of our corporate wealth, in terms of individual wealth, and the capacity of this nation to do the right things has never been greater. I think in the Financial Times I recently saw that 273 of the world's 500 richest companies are in the United States. 33 of the top 50 are in the United States. 16 of the world's top 20 are in the United States. This is about social choices that we're making. And the federal government has now, fortunately, gone from where it was in the 80s, which said, let's wipe out the Department of Education because it's a burden, to saying now we want more information, we want greater accountability, because we want to explore a new dialogue about potential partnerships with states to make sure states are making the right decisions at a time when higher education has never been needed more by any society, especially ours. So these are the types of discussions we need to have in Washington. And these are the types of discussions that need to go on. States are not independent operators in this. They haven't been in this program, and they will not continue to be if we continue to increase these tuition-based programs through loans and grants, giving states an easy out without addressing the partnership issue between us both. So that's essentially how we get to this. Now, what this will do, the VSA will do. The VSA will provide information to families and students about the individual college, more so than you'll find on any website. Madison's going to be part of it, but Madison will not have this page. The 23 California institutions, state institutions, will have this page. And this is aimed right at state legislators, this is aimed right at taxpayers, this is aimed right at corporate businesses and industry who know that diversification of higher education is essential for the workforce, and they know that how well we're actually doing with low-income students needs to be highlighted. Otherwise, if you simply put the percentage graduation rate and start measuring institutions by their percentage graduation rate alone, then we're all going to remove ourselves from the commitment to low-income students. We have a 50% graduation rate on our campus. We could have a 91% graduation rate in the next 5 years by only allowing our presidential scholars to enroll in our campus. We know how to do it, or out-of-state women, because we know how well they do, and they're dominating higher education in numbers that the men, we're constantly trying to get them to keep up. So these numbers are public good numbers, and we're going to be encouraging universities all over the United States to fess up to their public commitments and to have federal financing of these public commitments start to follow in partnerships with states. Noel?
Great. Very interesting presentation. Without the aid of a PowerPoint.
It probably works very better, actually.
Much better. No disrespect, David.
Yeah, right. Can only get by with a PowerPoint. Very interesting. I think it's really exciting. I have a couple questions. I followed that work a little bit in Washington, and I was wondering, I remember there was a discussion about including learning outcomes as a part of this whole area, because I think was the criticism in the sense that, okay, we have information on graduation rates, but we don't know if anybody actually learned anything when they went through college and the whole NESE.
David, you're exactly right. Pages 5, 6, and 7 The institutions will be asked. We're already doing many of these surveys with our own institutions, NESE and CLA, CQ and the others. We're already doing a number of these. What this actually, this database and access at the Department of Education will show is how your students are doing on certain areas that have been identified in by the VSA, certain areas of student value-added student learning in both curricular and co-curricular areas. For example, are your freshmen voting in larger numbers or percentages than as a freshman versus a senior? Community service, how many of your students are involved in community service? But CLA is going to take it into the learning aspects. Are your students learning more in particular fields of study? And that will be posted for people to see. Okay. And but the institutions will have a choice. They'll have a choice between three different standardized exams that will be offered, and they'll have to offer those exams once every 3 years and post that data on the VSA.
Okay, great, thanks.
It's a great point. It's the most complicated part of this.
Right.
It's the most.
Without turning it into no college student left behind. You know,
it's
a hard thing.
It is. It still leaves choice. Most of us are doing these exams anyway.
Right.
We're asking our students and sampling our students on NESE, or we're sampling them on CLA. And the examination organizations have agreed to work with us to reshape these to the thing, to ask the right kinds of questions that we think will be tailored towards what we think parents and students may want to learn from the each individual institution.
Yeah, just two questions. One, why doesn't Nostalgic want the last page? And secondly, aren't the graduate schools and NICU, Private College Association, aren't they coming out with a similar thing like
NICU
this?
NICU has a two-page document, but it looks just like U.S. News World Report, coincidentally. It's all inputs. It's
all
selectivity.
This actually, the
public, the Nostalgic and ASCU will have the same template. The only difference is in the California will have the back page, and we hope a bunch of others are going to adopt the back page with us.
Why didn't they adopt the back page?
They don't want to talk about net tuition. They don't want to talk about they're declining low-income student populations. They don't want to talk about the issues. They don't want numbers. They like percentages. When you're small, you like percentages because you can make yourself look a lot bigger and better when you don't talk about numbers. Public universities need to talk about numbers and driving these economies. And that back page is about numbers. It's about low-income students. It's about loan debt. NICU doesn't want to talk about loan debt, average loan debt, and percentage of students going into debt because they're not going to look as good. So the two pages of NICU look almost like U.S. News World Report. The public one will look more like, certainly like ours, but we hope others will adopt that back page as well.
You said Wisconsin was not going to use page 4.
Well, they haven't. They're part of Nostalgic has made no commitment whatsoever. In fact, there's still a bunch of Nostalgic institutions, the UC system, who actually would look good with page 4, but they're resisting doing the VSA at all. So there's still many Nostalgic flagship institutions who don't even want to put these 3 or 4 pages up, don't want to do CLA, don't want to do NESE. They think that they just want to do the minimum, the absolute minimum. Yes.
I'm wondering about online education, distance education. Are you going to be including statistics about what courses how many courses are offered online, and what do you think will be the political implications of those online courses? Right now, they're more pricey, more costly to administer than face-to-face courses. But will administrators in the future, will the colleges be required to have a greater and greater percentage in the future as they become more cost-effective?
They probably will, but there are no provisions for percentage of students doing online courses and percentage of students taking online programs. Now, that goes back to the costs issue. Anytime you start getting into the costs, which we would love to have these per-student expenditures analyzed by legislatures, by the federal government and others, because we've seen how they look. But the institutions with the most authority, the institutions with the most wealth, the institutions with the most political power are the same ones who don't want to talk about these expenditures and generally are the same ones who aren't doing online education. And so there's a great deal of resistance from certain areas to putting any variables that associate and tell parents and students about online.
Comments slash questions. Obviously, one really relates to, obviously this brings us back to the 72 debates. One thing that shouldn't be left out of our thinking about what happened is the fact that the 72 to 78 or 80 period was different than the period afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the role of student aid amounts relative to cost. So I want you to share some thoughts about that. And the second question is somewhat related. Within this partnership model, there's no component of the partnership for state grants. And whether or not, I mean, California, in a sense, is peculiar because, you know, it's gone from first in access in 1990-92 to about 40th.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's because you kept tuition down and didn't increase the seats. So you kept tuition down and aid up. So high tuition, low tuition, high aid, low seats is not a good access strategy. Mm-hmm. So how does this plan deal with the, other than the California kind of model, which is peculiar relative to access, how does it deal with the financial need problem that addresses the rest of the country? Because there's nothing in it for Palo.
For state grants?
State grant problem.
Well, you know, we're up to 11% in state grants as a percentage of all state appropriations. And
you mean in California or in?
Nationwide.
Okay.
And in those states that do state grants the best, the bulk of the state grants go to the tuition equalization model, probably more
tuition,
so.
Some tuition equalization models are need-based and others aren't. And mm-hmm. The non-need tuition equalization models are throwaways.
Right.
So we waste some money. We also use, so we can't really put them all in one kettle of fish.
Well, I would say that I would my comment to this, Ed, is the fact that the biggest crisis on tuition increases in the United States, and this is starting to be understood by many in the federal delegations, the student aid is a consequence of tuition increases. State for 80% of America's population, the ball gets rolling when the states cut their funding for higher education.
Well, Bennett said that, but it's never been proven. In fact, the research proves the opposite.
Well, most research proves the fact that state appropriations, the reductions of state appropriations, is the first reason why most college tuitions, public university tuitions, have gone up. Now, Ron Ehrenberg pointed out that in private higher education, the reason tuition goes up is because of competition with oneself and the other institutions. The peer competition in private sector. Now, for public higher education, the reason tuition goes up is because state appropriations it's the ebb and flow of state appropriations. Now, we increase our tuition twice as much when states cut our budget.
Well, your own statements about private colleges and Pell illustrates the way private colleges handled it, which is that they don't really even care about the low-income student anymore. So
right.
The argument, the Bennett argument at least, it kind of gets recrafted a little bit with loans, but the Bennett argument is proven wrong by the very things you've stated, which is the way to respond is to admit wealthy students. So we need to avoid that response, however we structure the next round of policy.
Well, we need to avoid the fact that institutions are behaving in this way. In fact, how does Michigan offset your revenue pattern in Michigan? You know, when you get to 40% out-of-state students, now, we're 1% out-of-state student. Now, I'll point this out. We could argue, and our state doesn't pay any California is a problem, it doesn't pay attention to anybody else. So we have 1% out-of-state student population. So you could argue that we're serving our state better than other publics in their state. Now, we are foregoing as a university $50 million a year in revenues if we go to the 15% national out-of-state rate. Now, Michigan, Virginia, Colorado, they have gone to out-of-state students to provide a vast amount of revenues. Now, an out-of-state student is worth far more than a Pell Grant student to an institution, and they cost a lot less to educate.
There is the California low tuition problem of little sad what's happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that the trying out the subsidy to the institution, the failed Title I, may make some sense. You know, maybe for some reasons. But it does nothing to solve the low-income access problem, because the way you've described it, it sets in cement the current funding tuition ratios and it does nothing to raise the Pell nor to incentivize states to get more state grants.
It actually, if you base the federal match on the state appropriation, like the Title I funds do, the Title I funds are based on...
Yeah, on the subsidy, right. To the, you're saying the subsidy, right. To the public.
Right, exactly.
Not
exactly.
To the student. So California, the exception, low cost, few seats. But Wisconsin, low state grants, more seats, some growth in access. So in this state, you need state grants because you've had a market system expanding the public system. And in fact, the biggest correlation of growth in public seats is tuition rise. So, and California exemplifies it from the bad end of the correlation. So
the way I can answer this is the biggest problem for students at public higher education, grants is one issue, but the biggest problem that continues to be the biggest issue in tuition escalation is the fact that state governments are removing themselves from the fiscal responsibility of
absolutely.
Of that's
the tuition, but that's for all. That, so you're kind and of that's, buying into the
right.
Every kid model.
Well,
years rather than the equity model.
Well, I think that states are going to continue doing what they're doing unless something isn't reversed, and the federal incentives of $90 billion in tuition-based assistance programs. Now, John Kerry's brilliant idea, and I have to say this, was to come forward with a $12,000 tuition tax credit for everybody, which, quite frankly, shows, I think, there's a regional issues here. Also, that it's less Democrat Republican and more regional, because John Kerry's probably never known a student who didn't have to pay $12,000 to go to college. In Florida, nobody would qualify for $12,000 tuition tax deduction or credit. California and most of the country, people wouldn't even qualify for $12,000. But in New England, they sure would. So the main issue here that I'm focusing on is not, I think support of good grants, Cal Grant B's versus A's, is indeed a priority for the federal government.
Correct.
And state government.
The pure need-based.
But the biggest problem right now is the fact that the states are removing themselves from this responsibility without any federal incentives. The same precedent, this isn't precedent setting, because you've got Medicaid and Title I doing the same thing to maintain effort.
I don't want to dominate it at all, but I just want to say, you're saying the bigger issue is protecting the public sector making low income accessible in the market model that exists. And that may be an appropriate response, but basically that's the argument.
I'm saying making sure the public sector remains true to the low income students.
It's protecting what it is.
It's protecting that before they all slide into privatization.
That's right.
And this campus.
Trying to draw a line in the
right.
sand and say, this is right. This is
right.
The public good.
Right.
This should be a priority.
Exactly. And it's to show that the Virginia movement, or perhaps Madison and others,
and UNC and others
that have been sliding towards less access to low-income students, is not going to get you any federal assistance. But if you remain committed to low-income students, you will be able to be entitled to further federal assistance, and incentivizing that for the state governments to pay attention to it as well.
Yeah.
It's always hard to follow Ed with his great observations on a policy level, and I have such a detailed question, so I apologize. But one of the things I took out of what you were saying was a strong advocacy to include this additional page. And as I look over the additional page, I see net price, which there's the net price calculator on page 3. I see you made the point that the number of degrees to go along with the graduation rates is essential. I see that on page 3 also. I'm lost.
There's
on
one.
Why you're
okay. There's one duplication.
The
only duplication, and that is to highlight the number of degrees. The number of degrees where you find that is interesting. The politics on why you see the percentages at the top of this VSA. We had a long argument about do not show these percentages unless those numbers are right beside them. Many institutions didn't want their numbers right beside them. They were smaller institutions who didn't want to expose. So buried in the bottom of page two are the same numbers. So what we're trying to do is highlight the numbers. Those numbers aren't as important to parents and students as they are to legislators and taxpayers. And those numbers, that's the only one, it's the upper left category. Those graduation numbers are both in the bottom of the second page, but also in the top of the public good page. The net tuition difference, there is a substantial difference in net tuition calculation. The calculation on page two in here is an individual family calculation where you put your income in. You put what you hope to pay to go to college, how much you or your son or daughter or yourself would end up paying to go to college. Now, that's very different than what an institution says their actual average cost of an FTE, of an average student. Say I wanted to go to Madison, and I want to know, what does the average family pay to go to Madison? And that number wasn't made available. A lot of discussion went on in that one. And in fact, the irony of that is that the VSA ultimately adopted the parental and student calculation on the second page, but the Reauthorization of the Higher Ed Act and George Miller want the net calculation of the average student. I think it does us greater justice to put the net calculation of the FTE student. And let me throw in one more reason why. When you use sticker prices, and Publix are at a distinct disadvantage with sticker pricing, and there's a lot of gaming in the sticker price system. Chavez Regal effect still goes on in some areas, and generally, Northeast. Now, the argument on sticker price is this: Madison could probably qualify 20% more students for aid and get about 25% more students on subsidized federal loans if they told the federal government that all of their students paid the full out-of-state rate, their highest rate available. Now, for us, Cal State Long Beach, we charge $3,000. But if we told the federal government that we charge $12,000 and a sticker price and then turn around and wrote an institutional aid award for the difference, a $9,000 institutional aid award, we would qualify more of our students, we've run the numbers, we'd qualify more of our students for federal subsidized loans. Now, people say that sounds fraudulent. Well, actually, what it really amounts to is it's not a level playing field. Because in the private sector higher education, it's just perceived as good business practice. Because they may only have 10%, Vanderbilt may only have 10% of their student population paying $40,000 a year. And the average net student is paying probably 23 or 24. Yet $40,000 is submitted to the federal government as the cost of attendance on behalf of all of their students. Now, I proposed this to my Board of Regents at Murray State University, that we do this at Murray State to get our students, and we ran the numbers to get them more aid. They looked at me and said, "You're going to go to jail." And I said, "No, it's how it works. If we're private, we'd be doing it like that every day." Now, the reason average net tuition is important is because there's discussion on getting that to be used instead of the inflated sticker pricing in the student aid formulas instead of the sticker price. And that may make people a little more honest about inflating sticker prices, and it may level the playing field a little bit more for public sector institutions who do not use the highest price as the average price for every student that attends the institution. Now, I say this hoping that Publix won't adopt it, but Miami University in Ohio has already adopted it. Miami charges all their students the full out-of-state rate, and they give, quote, an institutional aid scholarship, they call it Ohio Residency Scholarship, worth $7,000 to their Ohio residents. Well, they've already done it. Now, if our public sector institutions start doing the same thing, there's going to be such a public outcry but this is how it works. And this is many of the problems that Spellings, they were starting to understand, trying to get a handle on this system. It's not an informative system, an informative way. It's not transparent to the public at large. It's not accountable to the public at large. When you have some institutions saying they do this, yet they do this, and others do this, and they're doing this.
Can I ask just a follow-up question? And you're feeling like the more option is not adequate, that you feel a separate page to get some of these points across?
Well,
I mean, because we have the button to add additional information on each of the areas.
I think some of these issues are important enough. They're important enough to Chancellor Reed at the CSU system, who's one of the leaders in American higher education system leaders. It's important enough to our presidents that particularly when we put those low-income numbers in there, because nowhere on the VSA do they talk about socioeconomic level of students. Nowhere are they talking. And the danger is that if we don't put that on a separate page, that public institutions, like many privates, will just simply start paying attention to these numbers and further reduce their commitment to low-income students. They'll get lost in the shuffle because they're not going to be recognized or rewarded for being these public good measurements.
I guess I'm interested in your characterization of the benefit of the first three pages of the VSA. Given, I guess, from our perspective, it's less information than is provided to every college guidebook that we provide information to. It's less information and summarized at a more aggregate level than information on the common data set. So I guess when I think about this, I think the public already can get this information. Most parents of college students are buying
They can get some of it. They can get applications. They can get about 60% of those first three pages. What they can't get is, what they can't get will be those other pages on CLA information, the testing information.
I'm talking about the first three pages in particular.
Well,
what is the?
That's part
is
of my concern.
Is it a public relations benefit? Is that it's repackaging something in a different way?
In some ways, yes. The cool website hasn't worked, so nobody's tapped into it. So you're right. Some ways it is repackaging a lot of this information. In other ways, Nostalgic just wants to do the minimum. They think that we can do the minimum. We've got a change in administration. Spellings is going to be gone. There's going to be a turnover. So there are many institutions who simply want to do the minimum. What got thrown out of these discussions is more important than what's left in, with the exception of some of the testing results that'll go in there. And what got thrown out have a lot to do with the public good and who's remaining. What students are you serving? Whose students are you serving? Now, granted, parents, and the reason they don't want low, the argument to take low-income students out of the picture because was this. Parents don't want to hear about that. And so this boiled down to the fact that parents and students don't care. In fact, you could argue, and many parents might not tell you up front, but many parents don't want to know how many low-income students you have. In fact, they'd want less at the campus. So a number of these are fly in the face. The purpose is to make it more transparent to parents. About 60% you can get if you dig, and a lot of that information. The remaining set will be based on the test results from those exams that we're taking. But these other pieces that got thrown out, I think, are if you're going to remain committed to the public issues and the types of issues that legislators are talking to you about and whether you have the data to prove it, that's why that last page, and that's why California is adopting the last page.
A question. Why, I think that Carnegie back in 68, the Kirk Commission, Alice Riblin in the HEW report, and I think also Nixon's presidential address in March 1970, all proposed student grants and institutional funding. The question is, why did that not materialize? And Gladio and Wolanin don't talk about that.
Most people haven't spoken at all about the cost of education allowances that were supposed to follow those students to those institutions. And they have been left off the books, and now, surprisingly, most of the low-income students are still in the same institutions that they've always been. They're at the community colleges, and they're at the low-cost publics. And the cost of remedial programs, the cost of academic advising, the cost especially for large institutions who have large numbers of these students, is so much more substantial. I don't know why it never surfaced again, and maybe Jay, you were in the middle of all this, and Alan Ostar could tell us why it didn't surface, because certainly Askew played a role in this, not getting it out, but if this companion program had been adopted, at least there would have been incentives in place for those institutions to serve these students more and better.
This takes us back to the Dresch Weathersby arguments. Yeah. I mean, the National Commission and so forth, which is what silent, you know, it was delayed for a year. The National Commission said it would make a difference. And
then it vanished.
You know, and we did okay for a period of time. We weren't expanding access, though, which is, I think, the point Leah's made, you know, was having some equalizing effects, the Pell Grant was. You know, and now we're in a period of trying to expand access, and we're not really adjusting for the, what we might call the qualified left behind. It's not all the low income, but, you know, we need to get more through that pipeline. So the gamble you're making is saying that the additional subsidy, if it's funded, will make a difference in efforts to recruit low income.
I'd say it'll make the difference in recruit and retaining those low-income students. And because we've had to double our academic advice, I mean, it is a substantial cost. And a low-income student, a less educated coming from a poor school, requires more funding to finish. And institutions know this. Institutions know this. That's why many of them choose to just enroll a certain percentage or a small number. They can work very well with that small number and make sure they do well. But what about the institutions who have large numbers of low-income students? Large numbers of students coming from poor schools. Large numbers of students coming from schools who have, they've experienced these types of economic disparities since kindergarten. Because we've got to get into those schools too. We actually have to get in the EAP program, the college readiness program that our university is sponsoring. We have got to get into those schools to make sure those students are ready before they get here. Before they get here. I'll finish with I mentioned the EAP program. It's actually being adopted in a number of other states. With the EAP program, and we fund it ourselves along with Boeing. The state doesn't do this. The EAP program is an early assessment plan at the end of your junior year in high school. You take it with a state standardized test. The students take 45 extra minutes, and they sit there for 45 minutes, and they take an exam on college readiness in math and English. They get their results back in 6 weeks, right before they start their senior year. Their parents get the results, the schools get the results, and the students get the results. The exams tell them, are they college ready or not? And if they're not, they're immediately enrolled in their senior year and much more, using their senior year much more constructively and better than they ever would have used it if they waited until they found out at the end of their senior year they couldn't get in. Now, we have 65% of the students in the state of California taking the EAP exam. North Carolina's adopting it. Texas is adopting it. Florida's exploring it right now. And this, we actually are now taking the EAP exam to the eighth grade to see where these students should be, to see are they on the right track at eighth grade. Now, that costs money. And these types of programs can help and will help, but...
And that's where alignment support, I think Title I should be funding that, in a sense, something. You know, in other words, we got to align these things. And if the costs fall on colleges for the intervening of the prep, as they have for the supplemental student aid, then we're really getting into a very serious kind of financing of college problem.
And that's a philosophical discussion and... Yeah, that should be funded better, and they should be doing it. But if nobody's doing it, the state and the federal government saying, what are you doing to get your students college preparedness? Now, college preparedness is one of the issues of the Spellings Commission on accountability. What are the institutions doing to get students ready to go to college? Now, you could argue that that's not our responsibility, but if it's not getting done, it is our responsibility. We have to make sure that something's happening to help these students get college ready.
As I remember that period, you know, the reason some of that might have been dropped was because the advocates of institutional aid lost.
Yeah.
And it took several years before it got any traction back, you know, to influence things. So, like, my question is, then, what's different? What would bring this in now? What kind of politics? I mean, and back in that time, it was an alliance of Midwest and New England members of Congress who were educated at private colleges who looked at student aid and said, this is a way to help the poor and our alma maters. And that was sort of the political coalition that pushed it through. But now,
I think two things, and it was brought up earlier this morning. I think that there is a realization that we're, first of all, as a nation, we're not gaining any ground. And the rest of the world is moving pretty quickly. Interestingly enough, I was in India last spring, and India is building 1,500 new universities. Now, they've got a long way to go, but also India has one of the controversial issues in India is that in order to get public money, the federal government, the national government insists, and the states in India insist that each public institution enroll at least 40% from the lowest class, caste. And
the oversupply of PhDs to develop those institutions.
Yeah. So I think that there are some forces moving. And the first time we've ever been able to get in legislation a maintenance of effort provision for higher education to stabilize state appropriations. The first time we've ever heard many of the reauthorizers in Washington, nobody's arguing like they did in the 80s that the federal government doesn't have a role in this now. And the Department of Education, these are states' rights issues. I mean, the economic necessity of higher education on the world global market now has become too important for the federal government to ignore. And so you've got a number of forces that are converging in ways that I think have given Askew a leg up in a lot of these dialogues. Ed Elmendorf and Dino Curris, they've been in the middle of these, and they're called to first because they're less resistant on talking about ways to improve this system. Instead of saying what, and we're guilty in higher education. For the last 20 years, we've told the federal government, oh my God, the federal government, stay away from us. Cost controls. Oh, you're talking about accountability, cost controls. Well, I think we need to be on the winning side and shape these accountability issues so that we're actually spending money more wisely for the benefit of those who need them the most and the institutions who continue to serve them the most. Otherwise, we're going to have another Spellings Commission in, which will probably happen in 8 years. We had the College Cost Commission in 1997, and basically their summation of all that work was, well, we need more research after the College Cost Commission. Now we're back in Spellings 10 years later, and the same trends and the same concerns, they're just becoming more graphic because the world is moving much faster than we are, at least our peer economic nations are.
We'll take one final question from someone with a CSULB sweatshirt. I'm not sure what that means.
I didn't see that. Hey.
Hey. I wore it so we'd be sure and meet, and I met your lovely wife.
Oh, wonderful.
Hi. I'm so glad to see you here today. And I work for a pre-college program on campus with the goal of increasing diversity on this campus, Information Technology Academy. So when we talk about what are we doing, that's one thing. It's an uphill battle. Every day. So my heart's racing now because everything you're talking about today, I'm so excited. You know, it's really hopeful to think about the fact that these conversations are taking place. And was that your first presentation this morning? Yes, I was here for your presentation. I'm putting those together and thinking, this is everything that's the closest to my heart. So I'd like to just invite all of you, if you're interested, I think a lot of this work needs to be done on a personal level. Obviously, it's much bigger than that. But if you personally feel compelled to participate in this, there are things going on in this campus. And the Information Technology Academy is one of them. And please contact me. My name is Michelle McKiernan.
Michelle, the Academy is designed to help low-income and minority students?
Yes.
Now, let me ask you this. Does it cost money? Does the Academy cost money?
For whom?
It's a somewhat sarcastic question. That academy, your work that you're doing for so many in that academy costs this university money.
Oh, it does.
And those institutions that aren't worried about this or don't have a lot of students in these areas don't have to worry about spending that kind of money. And your program is an example of the type of programs that we're all trying to incorporate with actually quite efficient expenditure trends, still trying to adjust to this evolution. So you're a great example of what this would help fund and what these resources could be used to achieve.
I learned how at Cal State Law.
Hey.
I lied. There's one more question.
And I just want to add, we have a bunch of those pre-college programs that bring in students, and most of those students aren't required to apply for financial federal aid, so they're not included in our Pell Grant numbers, they may well serve us well to be in them.
And we've, in a particularly, this is particularly true for Latino populations. Our Latino students are the least likely. They will drop out of school before they'll take a subsidized loan out. And we've got to get good information in their hands. There are cultural issues. There are other things that take time, people, and effort to make sure that they are making the right decisions for their futures, not just the immediacy of today. And they may drop because they have a part-time job, and they won't take a subsidized loan out. Especially now that we've gotten the subsidized loan, we've gotten the banks out of the middle at least, and this will drop to 3.4% interest rate, which will help.
I'm going to have to cut it off. But Phil, talk to Kate.
One sentence.
Oh, you. All right, one sentence.
What?
One sentence.
A long sentence.
I just wanted to try to summarize what I think you're saying with something, infamous quote from Professor Hansen. If it's not counted, it's not done.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Count it. I'm saying count it.
Bartlett's quotations now?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
I never said it.
Phil, count it. Make everybody count it and pay attention.
It's not counted, it's not
That's
done.
Right. Count it and tell people whether you're doing it or not.
I want to thank everyone. Yeah. King Alexander.
Thank you, Noel. Thanks, Noel.
I also want to thank Dr. Ed St. John, Dr. Phil Trostel, and Dr. David Wirtz, and obviously, so thank you very much. And finally, thank you, and thanks our guests from Long Beach.